I'm a veterinarian, sure, but I'm way more than that. I am also a tango dancer, a struggling but determined pie maker, and a mom. With IndieVets, I get to choose when and where I work. I create my own schedule and choose shifts at nearby animal hospitals that are right for me. Having that flexibility is exactly what I need to have plenty of time for all those other things that I am. Because I'm more than just a vet. Visit IndieVets.com to learn more and apply.
Welcome back to the Indie Vets Happy Hour. I'm Andrew Heller, I'm your host, and I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Marissa Brunetti, VMD.
Great to be here, Andrew, though we are not in the same room.
No,
though
I know.
It feels like we are.
I know. What are you drinking today?
I am drinking still some Conchi Brewing Company, because we have a lot.
I'm going a little further than local. Cape May. Cape May IPA.
Okay. Ooh. Well, we do have some doctors in Southern New Jersey, so the Indie Vets do... We do go down to the ocean, so down the shore, as we say here in the Philly area. But we are continuing on today with our Pearls series, something we always wanted for general practitioners, which is 30 minutes or less, covering a very important or common topic that we see in general practice. We have already covered hyperthyroidism, hypothyroidism, Addison's disease, and now we're covering the opposite of Addison's disease, which is Cushing's disease, otherwise known as hyperadrenocorticism, but we'll call it Cushing's or HAC for short, or HAC.
Yes. Well, definitely check out those previous episodes. We had some great guests on. Actually, some of our Indie Vets joined us, and they were awesome. Thank you to them again. So today, as Marissa said, Cushing's is up. As usual, we like to say who this episode is going to be tailored towards. It is a Pearls series. So these are really just reminders for doctors, you know, veterinarians out there that are seeing these cases daily, but also for technicians that are right there alongside us. And hopefully this will teach you something. You know, you pet owners out there with certain breeds, which we'll get to, keep your eyes open for this particular disease process. So this disease, Cushing's disease, it's actually something that affects humans as well. It was discovered in 1932 by a great neurosurgeon. His name was Harvey Cushing. Mm. He discovered a link between certain physical characteristics, namely abnormal obesity of the face and trunk.
Interesting.
With the specific pituitary tumor. And so that's what we're going to be talking about today. So yeah, I mean, as Marissa said, Cushing's is the opposite of Addison's. And this is a disease where the body has too much corticosteroid hormone versus too little. And there's three different types of Cushing's disease. So one is pituitary dependent. And this is going to be the majority of cases that we'll see out there. About 85% of cases are this particular type. And basically what happens is the pituitary overproduces ACTH, cortisol. So it's typically a benign tumor of the pituitary. And so it's not something that has to be surgically removed, at least in our pets, something that we can treat medically, which we'll get to.
Right.
So what are the other two types, Marissa?
So another way you can get increased cortisol or increased corticosteroid in your body is if your adrenal gland has a tumor and it's overproducing that hormone. So adrenal tumors are less common, but 50% of them are malignant. So it's definitely important to differentiate between pituitary dependent or adrenal dependent Cushing's disease. And then lastly, something that unfortunately, you know, we have caused as veterinarians, iatrogenic Cushing's, which is high doses of steroids, can cause the pretty common typical clinical signs that you see with Cushing's animals. So look, we all know these, but let's just burn through these signs of disease that owners are going to report to you.
Sure. So PUPD, that's going to be a big one. Polyuria, polydipsia, drinking too much, urinating too much, and especially owners will report, you know, certain nocturnal polakiuria, which is, you know, dogs waking up in the middle of the night having to pee. So certainly something that triggers a trip to the vet. A lot of animals with Cushing's disease will have excessive panting, ravenous appetites. And, you know, you'll see this typical body type, which is like the saggy belly and this mobilization of fat from around the back, loss of muscle down into the belly. Skin issues are certainly something we see a lot of. Skin infections, hair loss. I don't know, they're usually pretty stinky dogs.
And they have some comorbidities, and you may notice, you know, recurrent UTIs, recurrent otitis, and hypertension. So those are things to look at. And also if you have proteinuria that you can't figure out where that's coming from, I definitely would move Cushing's up.
Yeah.
How about breeds? You know, we all know those typical breeds, but where are you seeing this, Andrew?
I'm thinking about poodles and dachshunds, Maltese.
Yorkies,
yeah. Boston Terriers. There's some others on the list that we don't need to talk about. Dandy Dinmont.
Never heard of that breed. anyone else heard of a Dandy Dinmont? We should probably look that up. But
I feel like I've seen one before.
I don't think I've ever seen one.
Come again? What is that? What is that breed?
Awesome. So obviously, Cushing's disease diagnosis can be a little tricky. And I think what I want to impress upon other GPs is it's not just one thing that you're looking for. It's not one, quote, positive test. We're treating if all of these things line up. So does this animal have clinical signs, right? What the owner is reporting to you. Do you find things in your exam that could be attributed to Cushing's disease? And then does the blood work support it? Does the blood work support additional testing for Cushing's disease? So I would say to everyone, like, yeah, you're going to see an older dog who's lost some muscle mass, and then you get their blood work back and you're like, oh my God, the alkaline is high. It must have Cushing's, right? Not always the case.
Is there a typical age of onset that you see this at?
It's usually middle-aged to older dogs in my experience. And that's kind of what I found in the literature as well.
Yeah.
So yeah. So Andrew, what sort of things on your routine screening blood work, CBC, CHEM, UA, are you going to see that support Cushing's disease?
Well, 90% of Cushing's dogs have an elevated ALP, alkaline phosphatase. They also have a mild elevation of ALT, an elevated potassium. And on a CBC, usually you see a stress leukogram, which is, you know, a mild neutrophilia, mild lymphopenia, and eosinopenia. You may see elevated platelets, elevated hematocrit, elevated PCV. And in the urine, as Marissa already mentioned, you'll likely see proteinuria, a more dilute urine, so usually a USG of less than 10-20. And if you culture it, often you'll find bacteriuria.
Yeah, that's excellent. So not just an increased alkaline with no clinical signs, right? We're not going to go, you know, asking for a low-dose Dex for these patients unless everything else fits. So that would be my first pearl is younger doctors out there, you're going to see a lot more elevation of alkaline that you chase and never find anything. That being said, if you do see it, obviously in an older dog and signs fit, then I think it's legitimate to suggest additional testing. So what are the three, quote, additional tests, you know, that we are familiar with in diagnosing Cushing's in dogs?
So the urine cortisol creatinine ratio, the UCCR, is a really easy way to rule out Cushing's. If the dog, you know, if you have a low suspicion and you just run this simple test and it's normal, you can basically say there's no Cushing's in this animal, which is great. You know, it's a relatively cheap test and, you know, it doesn't involve serial blood draws, things like that, which we'll talk about. It's not as sensitive as once thought. And, you know, you have to be careful with when you take the urine samples. Some recommend doing like a mixture of three different urine samples just to make sure that the stress levels haven't affected the cortisol levels in the urine. But it's pretty easy. If it's normal, you know, they don't have it. If it's elevated, you can't say they definitely have it, but you can at least go to the next test.
Right. So you would do that. And then the next test that you should just jump to anyway.
Which we could talk about the next test. There are two that you can choose from as a next test. There's an ACTH stim test and there's a low dose Dex suppression test. So why don't we talk about the ACTH first?
Yeah. So I would say, you know, Andrew and I were debating this before we started recording, but, you know, when I graduated in 2010, I would say I was taught to do the ACTH stim test first. It is a shorter test. It involves drawing a blood sample, injecting synthetic ACTH into the dog intravenously, waiting an hour, and then drawing another blood sample.
Yeah, I love that it's only 1 hour. It's so nice.
I know. It's very good. The tough part is, obviously, you know, you got to get the ACTH in intravenously. So hopefully your animal cooperates. This test is less sensitive than low-dose Dex in dogs with adrenal tumors, which means you're going to get more false negatives. But the good news is 80 to 85% of pituitary-dependent dogs will be positive.
Yeah.
It does have poor specificity in dogs with chronic disease, though. So I would say to everyone, like, if your patient is extremely ill, this may not be the best time to test for Cushing's because we may get some false positives.
Yeah.
When you're measuring your post, your 1 hour post, most labs use a cutoff of like 17 to 20 micrograms per deciliter. And so any serum concentration above this level is going to support hyperadrenocorticism. And then some pearls is, you know, you don't want to use the compounded ACTH gel products. Their biological effect is uncertain. Anything else to add about ACTH stim testing, Andrew?
Well, there are some drugs that can affect the test. So you just have to make sure that the animal has not been on prednisone or one of the derivatives of it. Dexamethasone's okay. I think we touched a little bit about that on that when we talked about Addison's disease. Does not affect this test. But phenobarbital and ketoconazole can also affect the outcomes of this. So make sure those are looked at before you're taking before you're looking at the results.
Yep.
The low dose dex suppression test, as I said before, is a longer test. It involves really 8 hours in the hospital. Some doctors will allow their clients to bring their patients back after 4 hours and after 8 hours. You really have to have compliant owners to do that. It's probably easier just to leave them there, but I can understand, you know, reducing stress levels in the pet can be important when doing this test. But it involves taking a pre-sample, injecting a small dose of dexamethasone, which is 0.01 to 0.015 mg per kg, IV, and then taking blood samples at 4 hours and 8 hours. And so what's cool about this test is it can actually differentiate, in many cases, between a pituitary dependent and an adrenal tumor if there's a positive result.
You look at the 8 hours first, right? So you look at the whole thing, and first you look at the 8 hour to make sure that it's really high. And if that's the case, then you go back and you look at the 4 hour. If you have an adrenal tumor, it'll never suppress at 4 or 8.
Right.
And if you have a pituitary dependent one, it will suppress at 4, but not at 8. And if you're suppressing at both, then you know you don't have Cushing's disease.
Then you're normal.
Yep.
Right?
You're normal.
And what's nice about this test is it's cheap, right? You're just using dexamethasone, which everybody has in their hospital or should have. And you can use dexamethasone or DexSP. You just have to make sure that you're using the right dosage, because DexSP actually has 3 mg per mil of dexamethasone, and dexamethasone on its own, I believe, is 2.
Correct.
2 mg per mil.
Yeah. Yeah. There is an interesting calculation. Maybe we can post it in our show notes that shows how to calculate it for 2 mg per ml or DexSP. So
what if you're dealing with a diabetic? You're going to do the low dose dex?
No, it's probably better to use the stim test for diabetics because you can get false positives. But it is nice to say that, like, if you do have a diabetic that has recurrent UTIs and you can't get the diabetes under control, it may be beneficial to test for Cushing's disease as well. They can have similar signs too.
So when do you use the high dose dex suppression test?
I don't ever, and I never have.
Okay. Perfect.
I think what we didn't talk about yet was the endogenous ACTH test.
Mm.
So for endogenous ACTH, it can be considered a differentiating test, but it is a tricky test. One, it's expensive. Two, it requires freezing and very careful handling. But if it works and you do all of it, it can show you that it should be high with pituitary dependent and low with an adrenal tumor. But I don't think I've ever used it, but it's there.
And for anybody thinking about doing a resting cortisol, there's no diagnostic value there. Don't do it.
Mm-mm. Nope. And like we said, for ACTH, you do have to ensure that you're giving the dexamethasone, no matter what strength it is, intravenously. So don't forget, just like when you're doing a stim test and you're giving the ACTH, you also have to make sure that you're giving the dexamethasone IV or the test will fail.
Right. And since, you know, when you're giving dexamethasone, it can be a really tiny amount, you can increase the volume with saline. And that way, you know that you're getting in the vein properly.
Yeah, that's a good point. So let's go through treatment of this disease. And I'm just going to reiterate again, you're treating if there are clinical signs and the lab work supports your diagnosis and your differentiating tests support your diagnosis as well. This is a lifelong disease, which likely requires lifelong therapy if the dog has clinical signs. And the treatment is focused on controlling the clinical signs, unless you do an adrenalectomy and take out the adrenal tumor. So differentiation first is important because there can be different treatments, right? Let's talk about the most common choice for medical treatment.
That would be triclosan, better known as Vetoryl for most veterinarians in the United States. This is really taken over from the older treatment, which was Mitotane, which we can talk about a little bit, but
Marissa doesn't want to talk about it.
Okay, we're not going to talk about Mitotane. We'll just talk about triclosan. It's a relatively safe drug. How does it work?
It basically is a synthetic steroid, and it blocks the production of several cortical hormones in the adrenal gland. Okay, it just blocks this.
Yeah.
Okay, so you get less steroid hormone. We don't need to say the very long word that no one's going to remember. You just need to know that it inhibits the production of several steroid hormones.
Which means it can work for a PDH or an adrenal tumor.
Correct. And, you know, I want people to know that it's hard to get the dosing right on the first try. So don't get, you know, discouraged. This is not usually an emergent disease that you need to control right away. And so sometimes it can take, you know, 2 to 3 dose adjustments to get it right or more. And so I will say the label, basically the label dose is 2.2 to 6.7 mgs per kg once a day.
That's a huge range.
It's a big range, right? And so most internists and myself anecdotally have found to start with a lower dose. So like a lot of dogs are being started on 2 to 3 mgs per kg total dose a day, whether that's twice a day or once a day. I will say that I always had better success with twice a day dosing.
Yeah.
So if I started it at once, like the label said, and I did my recheck in, you know, 14 days or, you know, and then 30 days, and we still weren't controlled, I would split it to twice a day.
Well, most pet owners will say that they're good during the day and then at night they're still waking up. And that's when sometimes you want to split the dose and definitely give, you know, the morning dose and the evening dose.
Yep. What I thought was interesting, as veterinarians, we're very specific about our doses, right? Unlike humans that get like one tab for every human, we are very particular about doing our triclosan doses. And so I just want to say it is acceptable to round down to the nearest appropriate capsule size because you can go slow. If you don't know to go up or go down, go down. And we may have to increase, but it is important, right? If you over supplement them, if this dose is too high, you're going to get too low of cortisol in your body. And that, as we know, is not good. So important to teach your pet owners about the signs of low cortisol. So, you know, they're eating less or not at all. They show signs of weakness or lethargy. They show signs of vomiting and diarrhea. All the signs we went over in Addison's, you're basically making the dog Addisonian with your medication. So if your owners see this, and if some owners are really anxious, you know, you can give them like a doses of prednisone to have on hand at home. And usually these dogs, if they do have low cortisol, the affected dogs will improve within 2 hours of administering like one dose of pred, which is like 0.5 mgs per kg. Then you would withhold the triclosan dose for like 1 to 2 days and consider a lower dose, like 50 to 75% of the regular dose, using clinical signs to kind of tell when you have to start again.
Are you usually monitoring at certain intervals after getting them on the right dose?
Yep. So when you first start, obviously it's almost like a diabetic. And so you're going to use the ACTH stim to monitor once you've diagnosed and started them on triclosan. And so I usually schedule a stim 10 to 14 days after starting them on triclosan, and then at 30 days, 90 days, and then every 4 to 6 months once you, you know, get them on a very good dose. But the important part about doing your monitoring test is that it is time dependent. And so you want to make sure that they're giving the triclosan in the morning, and then per the label, you wait 4 to 6 hours, and that's when you start. Mm. I will say there are different internists that say different things. Like I remember at one point it was 2 to 3 hours, right? So I think starting at 3 to 4, you know, you're probably fine, but the label still does say 4 to 6 hours post-dosing. So I also in the beginning would do a chemistry and electrolyte check as well when I was drawing the blood for the pre, and then you're going to get your results. And they're not always going to look like what you want them to look like. And so once again, you're looking at the whole animal. And so if you see the target, you want to be between like, you know, 1.4 and 5.4, right? But there are plenty of dogs whose clinical signs go away and their numbers are high, like 5 to 9.
Yeah.
So if you do see something that is technically, quote, out of range and looks high, evaluate the dog. If the owner says the clinical signs are gone, I would not change the dose at that point.
Great.
We just went over what it was like if the dog didn't have clinical signs, but its levels were still high. Don't change. If you have a dog that still is showing clinical signs and your test is your ACTH stim is greater than 7, I would increase my dose by 25 to 50%. If they're showing clinical signs, but your post-ACTH is less than 7, and you're only giving it once a day, if you're only giving triazolam once a day, I would go to twice a day with the same dose. Mm. Take that one whole one dose, split it into two, and do BID, wait 10 to 14 days and test again. If there's still no acceptable response with that, then you're going to start slowly increasing, you know, 15 to 25%.
Yeah.
It's unfortunately in capsule form, which makes moving a little bit more difficult, but, you know, we've been dealing with that for a while.
So one thing I did want to talk about before we end is, you know, when you have a diabetic and you have a diabetic that's difficult to control, a lot of veterinarians get pretty frustrated by this particular case. What would you say in terms of, you know, next steps there?
I briefly mentioned it earlier. If you have like a poorly controlled diabetic or you're continuing to see proteinuria or you're continuing to see UTIs, a PUPD, I would test. You know, I would test those dogs for Cushing's. And if they are Cushingoid and diabetic, once I started the triazolam, I would reduce the insulin dose. I would consult an internist for that, though, based on, you know, how the dog is doing. I think you have to look at a number of factors. But if you control the Cushing's and you're still at the same level of insulin, you may really be pushing your patient into hypoglycemia. So I would be really careful when starting.
Great. Anything else you want to talk about with this case?
Cushing's is really frustrating. And I would just caution you guys once again that you got to look at the whole animal. And before you launch into a treatment plan and a testing plan and getting your owners on board for, you know, a lifelong treatment, I would make sure that the treatment is doing what you need it to do, right? And that's making sure the animal is comfortable and doesn't have those clinical signs. Most Cushingoid dogs, like, it's not emergent. And I will say there's a ton of dogs out there that I know that aren't being treated.
And untreated. And
Untreated, yeah. So.
We hope you enjoyed this episode on the Indie Vets Happy Hour. Thank you so much for listening. Tell your friends. And if you like us, leave us a 5-star review and make sure to subscribe so you can be alerted whenever a new episode is available. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, email us at clinical@indievets.com.
Cheers.
Cheers.